It's the time of year when we hear a lot of claims and accusations being made by politicians. Here's Illinois Comptroller Leslie Munger speaking at a Chicago Sun-Times editorial debate recently.
My opponent was on both the city of Chicago payroll and the state of Illinois payroll simultaneously, taking full salary, funding her full pension benefits.
Is that true? PolitiFact Illinois joins us for a new weekly segment on political myth-busting. Also, a look at how the solar industry is hoping to employ many laid-off co-workers in southern Illinois. And it's the time of year when you get a flu shot. But we also know that means lots of questions about influenza and the vaccine to protect ourselves against it.
We still need to recognize that influenza, which is an unpredictable disease, causes significant illness and even death.
We have a doctor to answer all your flu shot questions. Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. Or tweet to 21st Show, and we'll take your questions in just a few minutes, but first, the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's flu season. I'm planning to get my flu shot this afternoon. In a few minutes, we're going to have a doctor from Springfield on the line with us to talk about influenza this season and answer any flu shot questions you have. Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455 or tweet to 21st Show. That's coming up in just a few minutes. But first, the ongoing investigation into fraud at Wells Fargo is costing the bank yet another high-profile client, the state of Illinois. State Treasurer Mike Frericks held a news conference this morning in Chicago to announce plans to suspend billions of dollars in investment activity with Wells Fargo. According to their own admission, Wells Fargo employees fraudulently opened about 2 million unauthorized deposit, credit card, debit card, and online banking accounts for its customers from 2011 to 2015. Here's what Treasurer Frerich said earlier this morning.
To meet sales targets and compensation incentives is downright shameful. Wells Fargo is a big financial player in Illinois, and I hope to send the message that their unscrupulous practices are not welcomed and will not be tolerated.
Also speaking at this morning's news conference, Dori Rand. She's the president of the Woodstock Institute. That's a Chicago-based research, policy, and advocacy organization advancing causes of financial justice. She talked about how hard it will be for victims of this financial fraud.
For over 43 years, we've advocated for safe and affordable financial products and services. So we strongly support Treasurer Frerich's decision to pull out from working with Wells Fargo and to try to help refund money to victims of its abuses. It's bad enough that Wells Fargo rewarded aggressive account openings and sales of toxic products like deposit advances and overdrafts that trap consumers in debt. But what made that even worse is the fact that Wells Fargo uses forced arbitration clauses and waivers of class actions in its consumer contracts, so that even when victims of these abuses tried to sue them in court, their cases were thrown out and the violations were allowed to continue for years. So we call on Wells Fargo not only to stop the abusive account openings and the other issues that they were charged with by the CFPB and the OCC and the LA attorney, but to also stop using forced arbitration clauses and class action waivers in its contracts. Thank you.
Dori Rand at a news conference. She's president of the Woodstock Institute, a Chicago-based organization. Treasurer Frerich said the moratorium on investment activity with Wells Fargo will remain in effect for 1 year. Last week, California also suspended its business activity with Wells Fargo. On Friday, the city of Chicago proposed a similar suspension. You're listening to the 21st. Fall means the flu for people around the state and country. Although we learn more and more about the virus each year, there's often still questions from people about whether or not you should get a flu vaccine. The CDC and other infectious disease specialists note a recent drop in seasonal flu vaccination. About 45% of the U.S. population got vaccinated against the flu virus last year. That's down about 1.5% from the previous year. With us today is Dr. Stephen Amara. He's the medical director of infection prevention at Memorial Medical Center in Springfield. And he's here to talk to us a little bit more about the influenza virus. To answer your questions, if you have any about flu shots, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet your questions or comments as well to 21st Show. Dr. Amara, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
You're
Thank you.
Let's get this first question out of the way, because there's been some debate about this press, particularly in recent weeks. When's the best time for you to get a flu shot?
The best time to get a flu shot is as soon as it's available. Many people come to the office saying they're going to wait until the end of October or November to make sure that they have good activity when the flu comes. But the time of presentation of influenza varies, and it's better to have protection as early as possible rather than to wait.
I think people wait because they think it might wear off and then the influenza season continues, but perhaps the effectiveness of the vaccination does not. How do you respond to people when they say that?
Well, in terms of whether or not it will wear off, really it's a question as to whether or not they will respond to it in the first place. People who make a good immune response to the influenza vaccination are protected throughout the season against the strain of virus that is predicted to circulate in the community. As to whether or not that is effective really depends upon how good a prediction a committee that is sponsored by the World Health Organization and CDC meets to try to determine which strains of influenza are going to circulate, and that is how that vaccine is selected. For this year, we have no use of the live vaccine because the match was felt to be poor. The match for the inactivated vaccines, however, is felt to be adequate, and so the vaccine is recommended. In terms of immune responses can vary depending upon the health status of the person, but especially for people older than the age of 65, where the immune system, like everything else, becomes older and is poorer to respond.
Yeah, Dr. Amara, I wanted to ask you about a couple things you said there. Let's start first with the immune response. What do you mean when you say someone doesn't have a good immune response? Does it mean you can get the vaccination, but sometimes it doesn't help? What does that mean?
Well, let's talk about age-related immune senescence, and that's something that we look at influenza mortality. The mortality for influenza is 3,000 to 49,000 people per year, depending upon the strain.
And is that 49,000 people a year? Across the world?
No, that's across the United States.
So that's how many people can die from influenza every
year?
Die
from influenza or influenza-related illnesses, which means they get pneumonia after influenza, etc.
So 50,000 people. Okay.
Yeah, many of those are older than the age of 65. And what happens to the immune system older than the age of 65 is kind of like the U.S. military being restricted in that it can't recruit anymore. New recruits are not brought in. As a consequence of that, the immune components become older or they become obsolete, and they can't meet demands of changes in the viruses or bacteria that they're asked to encounter and deal with. And so we see that especially as people get into their 90s, but in their 80s, that they make poor responses to vaccinations. It doesn't work that well. So that's one issue. The other issue would be acquired immune response problems. And they occur because of diseases. A good example is chronic lymphatic leukemia, where the patient has a monotonous clone of a certain type of cell called a B cell that produces antibodies. Well, they don't produce very well these proteins because the proteins that are produced are monotonous. And so we have to give them antibody in the form of an infusion. These are proteins that fight infections just like smart bombs would attack potential threat to the United States. Mm-hmm. And so we just don't make them. The contractors don't make the proteins, or they make them, but they make only one kind, and thus it becomes obsolete. And so you have to kind of replace those. So that's an example. Another example would be, of course, HIV infection. But that infection really affects all across the immune system if it's not treated properly, because it takes out the command and control of the immune system by attacking the generals of the immune system.
Okay. So, Dr. Amara, this is the argument that's often made in favor of flu shots, correct? That because there are some people who don't have immunity, it's important for other people to get them in order to protect them. That's sort of the vaccination argument that normally that the medical community makes, right?
Well, it's both a personal and a professional issue. In terms of working through a healthcare system, the opportunity to work in a healthcare system is a privilege and not a right. And we have very sick people in the hospital, many of them with immune compromise for this or the reasons I just mentioned, but others as well. And as a consequence, we require people who are working in healthcare settings to make themselves immune to influenza or to take alternative measures if they don't, usually wearing a mask during flu season. That actually becomes somewhat cumbersome if you're a healthcare worker because of the time that you're spending in the hospital. Treatment for the general population is recommended for anybody over the age of 4. There is an inactivated vaccine for 4-year-olds and above, and then as well for anybody over the age of 18, regardless, because this is a protein that is not alive and it does not is not able to formulate itself into a flu vaccine or cause an influenza illness in and of itself. There's a lot of people, however, who reject that flu vaccine, and they do it on the basis of a lot of reasons. Concern about the constituents of the vaccine that would cause something. I know somebody, one of the actors or actresses, I think it's Jenny McCarthy, was concerned about autism in vaccines, and I think that's been disproven in several studies.
Right. Well, and with this, I mean, we're talking about the flu vaccine. I think it's been a very different conversation than childhood immunizations. When we're talking about the flu shot and the influenza virus and the flu vaccine, you mentioned something about what sort of, I know every year there's an international committee that meets to determine, look at what strains need to go into the vaccine. You mentioned that this year there isn't a live vaccine within the influenza vaccination. How does that get determined? How do they try to figure out what they think, what different strains of influenza may be a big thing this year?
Influenza is a spring and summertime illness in the Far East, and it is a wintertime illness in the Western world, in the United States, Canada, et cetera. The committees that meet are from the World Health Organization, and they are from Tokyo, Japan, and they're from Melbourne, Australia. There is a city in China. It's not Peking. It's actually Hong Kong. And the CDC in Atlanta. Representatives from all of these places meet and look at viral strains that have been recovered from the Far East during the spring and summer influenza times in that Far Eastern area. In the United States, it's possible to get influenza in the summer if you travel to Alaska. That kind of gives you an idea where that comes from. They sit down and look at all of these strains and see which are the most common, and they match up proteins called H and N. H is a hemagglutinin and N is a neuraminidase. And those are the markers on the cell that determine virulence. If the population is exposed to a virus that has an H and an N not seen before, then we will likely see a pandemic with severe illness. Fortunately, for most of the population, they have seen at least one, if not both of these, at some time during their life when they built their immune response.
Mm-hmm. So what about people who say to you, Dr. Amara, what about people who say to you, I don't get sick, or the virus doesn't work, I still get sick? How was your response to that?
Well, there are many illnesses that circulate in the winter months, and influenza virus is simply one of those. Influenza in a young person may cause a very high fever, but they will usually survive it without a problem. Usually I see that is one excuse. The other excuse I see commonly is they're worried about Guillain-Barré syndrome because of what happened in the 1970s. Influenza does not protect against things like parainfluenza or the rhinoviruses or some of the other viruses that circulate in the winter or the enteroviruses that circulate in the early fall. But it does protect against influenza, which can cause mortality in the older population. And it protects against certain complications that can occur in younger people, especially in younger people who are heavy or who may be pregnant. They are susceptible to severe complications, including shock with influenza infection. We use the inactivated vaccines in that group. As far as Guillain-Barré syndrome goes, there was a study in Canada looking at Guillain-Barré syndrome in people who had actual influenza versus the vaccine. And the influenza that circulates in the community is 17 times more likely to cause Guillain-Barré than is the vaccine.
Dr. Amara, I wanted to ask you about when we think about different populations, making sure that they're getting flu shots now. You started this conversation saying this is the time of year to get them. We received an email from the governor's office last week encouraging Illinois residents to get their flu shots. And in the message, Lieutenant Governor Evelyn Sanguinetti said she's urging everyone, especially in Latino communities, to get a flu shot. And she said that quote, for a number of reasons, Latinos are less likely to get vaccinated. Do we know why that's the case?
I'm not entirely clear. I would have to have some community outreach with Latino communities and see what their concerns are regarding the vaccine.
What happens if there are, right? I guess maybe the other question is, if we see different large percentages of certain communities foregoing the vaccine, what do you think could happen?
Well, unfortunately, then they will get circulating influenza, and influenza in a unprotected population is kind of like an ice storm in central Illinois in January. It'll knock off branches that are weak, and the weak branches tend to be our 65-year-old population and older, or those who are sick or ill for other reasons prior to age 65 who are susceptible to illness, including people with cancers, people who have lung diseases, people with arthritis who are on immunosuppressive drugs, et cetera. So we really don't want to turn our people into people, or our population into people who transmit flu in that way and end up with these severe morbidity and mortality associated with the flu. We would like to get people protected, and really the vaccine is indicated for everyone. The true contraindications for the vaccine are a severe allergy to the vaccine or its components, a history of Guillain-Barré syndrome within 6 weeks of a prior influenza vaccination, and then a true egg allergy. However, there is an egg-free vaccine. And then there are religious objections. In general, at Memorial Medical Center, we request a letter from the religious director indicating that this person is to be excused for influenza vaccination for the following faith reasons before we will accept that. After that, the healthcare worker either gets reassigned to a non-patient care role or wears a mask during the flu season or takes a prophylactic medication if the flu season is really intense.
So thanks for joining us. It's Dr. Stephen Amara. He's the medical director of infection prevention at Memorial Medical Center in Springfield. He's also infectious disease and foreign travel medicine chairman at Springfield Clinic. Dr. Amara, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
For tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. By the way, you can always catch us on social media to know what we're doing, what past shows we've had, or give us feedback. If you go to www.21stshow.org, that's our website that has our social media channels, including Facebook, Twitter, our email, our hotline. If you want to give us a call, 217-200-3131 is our hotline number. A few weeks ago on the program, we talked about the coal industry and how many towns, especially in southern Illinois, haven't ever really recovered from decades of job loss. Here's Jody Hodge, a retired union coal miner from Taylorville in central Illinois, who describes what happened to her town once jobs were cut.
The unemployment rate went really high. You know, we lost money for the schools. We lost money for the roads. There was a lot of money because of the taxes that they was paying for that coal. We had a lot more money coming in. And after that, it hasn't recovered.
Well, today we wanted to focus on some good news and some efforts that the solar industry is making to try to retrain workers to work in their industry. In a few minutes, we'll be speaking with the president of the Illinois Solar Energy Association. They just announced last week a grant from the USDA Rural Business Development Project that will allow for training to electrical contractors so they can work on solar installations in southern Illinois. But we wanted to start in San Diego and with Solar Alliance, which is based there. Eric Knudsen is the company's CFO. They've also just announced plans to create some jobs around the Marion, Illinois area. Eric, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Eric, hi. Why did a San Diego-based solar energy company decide, hey, I think we should look to laid off coal workers in southern Illinois to find work in the solar energy industry?
It was a brainstorming session we had within our company, and we knew that, well, there's a transition needed across the country when it comes to different segments of the industry. And it was close to my heart, so I kind of raised my hand when we had the brainstorming session and said, hey, I know where there's some unemployed or underemployed coal workers. Let's see if we can help them.
And your family has roots in southern Illinois. In fact, in Marion, how much time did you spend there as a kid?
I was there every year for couple of weeks visiting with all my cousins and all of that. It was my parents that met there, and they actually were married there as well.
And so for you, you had those sort of family ties. What did you know in terms of your visits there sort of growing up about the economy and coal, and why did you think of Marion?
Well, all too little as a child, because I was so young, you know, from baby onwards. But in the last, 10 years, I think I've been able to have discussions with my relatives and what the challenges are when it comes to employment. And of recent, my mom moved back. My parents had moved. My father was a pilot, had moved back from Hawaii. And my mom, after my dad's passing a couple years back, moved back home to Southern Illinois. So I've been there actually several times over the last year and been connected well. And I think with that inspiration from the unemployment that I saw there, I was like, well, let's do it. And the rest of the team here at Solar Alliance supported the whole idea.
Eric, what kind of work are you talking about? What's the goal? What would you like to do?
Well, the goal is to address the need for embracing new forms of energy production. There's, you know, we've got to respect what is out there today. You know, you've got coal production, a lot of jobs. You've got even oil and other forms of production that are made from other forms of energy or types of fossil fuel to make energy. And when it came to the future, we know that our discussions have been around, well, what kind of energy production do we want to look at and get connected with? And solar is one of those that here at my team we're very enthralled with. We think, hey, there's a future for that.
And so with that said, what kind of jobs would you like to see? What kind of jobs are you all planning on? This is next year in Southern Illinois. Is this working on solar installation? What are you all planning to do?
It is solar installation, and there's three types of jobs. One is project leadership, you know, connecting up with the sites that we're targeting. Another is construction. How can we construct these solar energy panels that need to be really assembled? The construction itself of the panels themselves, we'd even like to see in the state of Illinois. We've even got an inquiry from one manufacturer around that. I don't know if that's even possible, but we're very ambitious here. A lot of the panels aren't today produced in the U.S., but if we get one that's even U.S. made, that'd be great. And assembling those panels is that second type of job. The third is maintenance. As they grow, these different areas that we put in solar, there'll be need for maintenance. So really there's three basic types of jobs then.
Now, you all made an announcement. It was highlighted at the Clinton Global Initiative. The Clinton Foundation was talking about what you all would like to do. Are you hoping to take advantage of Workforce Adjustment Act, sort of retraining dollars, federal dollars that are there to also kind of match up and make an investment that you all are thinking about in different towns?
I hope so. We haven't gotten that far. We're more interested in finding skilled or ambitious people that want to learn the skill sets and have the competence maybe from the coal industry that are today underemployed, maybe taking on jobs that don't really leverage their skill sets they've learned in the coal industry or that are truly unemployed and not working today. That's where our heart is. But in conjunction with that, we know that we want to move forward and have the workforce development programs in place that develop the team members over a number of months to be able to really participate actively and create these jobs that are long term.
Eric, what kind of response are you getting from different towns since you made the announcement last week?
It's amazingly positive. We had no idea that we would get so many calls from so many individuals. We've got a real proactive response from a local mayor. I will say that anonymously because I don't want to embarrass him, but it's fantastic from leads of municipalities like that or towns through to one of the airport leads got back to us. The local utility, one of the colleges is interested. And so with this in mind, we're seeing a great response. There's certainly a need there, and we see it fits well with the retraining that's possible here of unemployed, underemployed coal workers into the new industry and work in parallel with those other industries like the coal industry.
It's Eric Knutson, CFO of San Diego-based Solar Alliance, with their plans for a couple dozen jobs in 2017 in the solar industry in Southern Illinois. Eric, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
You know, Eric was just talking about retraining and the retraining dollars available. One program in Southern Illinois that's going to be training electrical contractors to install solar projects is being led by the Illinois Solar Energy Association. That's a solar education and advocacy group. Shannon Fulton serves as president of the board for the ISEA and joins us now from Bloomington. Shannon, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
How many people do you expect to train with this latest project that you just announced recently?
The program will train 8 individuals from both union and non-union electrical contractors in the southern part of the state.
And I know this is happening with help from a USDA Rural Business Development grant. How much money is coming from the grant for this training, and what is it going to be used for?
The USDA grant will provide funding in excess of $31,000 to provide the classroom and hands-on training. And then an additional amount of $4,000 is coming from Illinois Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity. So this is going a long way to provide both the classroom and hands-on training that these electrical contractors will need in order to sit for the NABCEP exam, the North American Board of Certified Energy Practitioners exam, which is the gold standard for the solar industry in the country and one of the pathways into becoming a certified distributed generation contractor in the state of Illinois, which is a requirement. And currently, there are only 3 of those certified DG installers in the southern part of the state out of 127. So we're expecting that this pilot program, it's the first of a series of educational offerings that ISEA plans to offer in this region. Will begin to prepare electrical contractors for this type of kind of cross-training to get into this newer industry for them.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about that there's 127 electrical contractors in Illinois who are qualified to, is this to perform solar installation panels and homes, or what kind of work are we talking about in particular?
Yeah, so to be clear, that number of 127 is the number of currently certified distributed generation installers in the state. Some electrical contractors, solar developers, installers, the type that qualifies for that certification is a little bit varied, but a lot of them are electrical contractors. And so these are entities that are developing and installing solar panels on, yes, homes, businesses, nonprofit entities, mm-hmm. distributed generation.
Mm-hmm. And when we look at the solar industry in Illinois as a whole, how many jobs do you expect to see in coming years in the states? What in Illinois?
Well, we currently only have we have less than 1,000 solar installations in the state. This is less than 0.1% of Illinois' 5% net metering cap. We expect this small pilot program alone, when you combine the professional education with the public education component that ISEA is planning to offer, to provide for an estimated at least 50 new jobs, 50. So, if we can continue to have these types of pilot programs and the type of program that Eric is speaking about is wonderful as well, we can see this industry begin to develop the workforce to meet the growth that we are waiting for here. If we can fix the RPS, we certainly will see that growth expand quite rapidly, actually. There's a bit of energy legislation in front of the legislature right now that is poised to really expand the solar industry and market.
I'm sorry, Shannon, you said RPS? What's that?
The Renewable Portfolio Standard in Illinois. It was quite a progressive one when it was developed and has since really not functioned the way it was intended to function because of electricity aggregation, municipal aggregation, which has been a wonderful thing for the state, but has kind of inadvertently caused the Renewable Portfolio Standard goals to just not be met.
Shannon,
so there's legislation.
Yeah. When we're thinking about the solar industry and we're thinking about the jobs, we've talked about electrical contractors. Eric was mentioning construction, perhaps, or even the possibility of manufacturing. What kind of skills and expertise do you think will be most needed for workers in the solar industry in Illinois?
Well, with the growth that we hope for, you know, the changes will provide the economy with particularly valuable middle skills jobs. So these jobs would require some college, perhaps a certification or apprenticeship, but not necessarily a college degree. You know, Illinois really is facing a large gap of these middle skills jobs that we think that the transition perhaps from a fossil fuel-based energy market will provide. Currently, these positions account for about 54% of jobs in the economy, but only 43% of Illinoisans are trained to perform them. So with the RPS increase, if the Clean Jobs Bill passes, you know, we can perhaps see up to a 53% net job increase in solar alone.
And of course, that's, so, as you said, contingent. So it sounds like a lot of these jobs are contingent on legislation passing.
To some degree. If we want to see the kind of growth that can offset this transition to a clean energy economy, definitely it's legislation contingent.
And
we need smart legislation in Illinois for progress and job growth.
And Shannon, we've been talking, you know, Eric was talking about the idea of retraining former coworkers. One thing we heard, you know, we started this conversation speaking, playing some of a bit of a conversation with a retired coal miner from Taylorville in central Illinois. And one thing she said was that the really tough thing about this is a lot of the jobs that have come forth don't pay as well as the coal industry did. What are pay rates like? Were people doing? And I don't know if there's even a comparable job within the solar energy industry, but what are we looking, what does it look like in terms of pay rates? Is it something that would be comparable?
Well, I am not familiar with what individuals in the coal industry are being paid. However, in the solar industry, you can expect for these middle skill level jobs anywhere from, I would say, you know, $18 to $30 an hour, depending on what type of skills that you have and what type of job you're performing.
So I know when we're talking about, I know coal miners thinking about annual sort of like 70,000. So not exactly, in fact, that's almost, well, I guess it's not half, but a little bit less than that when we're thinking about annual salaries. But as you think about this and you're thinking about the training that's needed, we just have about a minute left. So I just wanted to ask you, I mean, what would you like to see as president of the Illinois Solar Energy Association? What's the most important priority for you with jobs going forward?
Well, certainly, you know, the ISEA has a long history of providing, you know, public and professional education. So it certainly is very much a part of our mission to advance this type of professional education for individuals who need it and who are interested in it. I really, though, without smart energy policy, we're just simply not going to get there.
Mm.
Right now, we're operating in this area of uncertainty, and until the Clean Jobs Bill or something very close to it passes, we certainly won't see the type of growth in the industry that will then support the jobs that we hope to see and hope.
Thanks for that. Yeah, Shannon Fulton is a board president with the Illinois Solar Energy Association. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. On Mondays, we talk politics with reporters covering political issues, whether that's Illinois or elsewhere. And we thought leading up to the election, we would devote this space to fact-checking. With politicians making all kinds of claims about themselves, flinging accusations at their opponents, it can be difficult to sift the truth from the not. Thankfully, there are many journalists who are working to figure that out, including Reboot Illinois, which has partnered with PolitiFact to take on that responsibility this election season. Matt Dietrich is the editor of Reboot Illinois. The Pulitzer Prize-winning website PolitiFact has partnered with Reboot Illinois to create PolitiFact Illinois. That happened earlier this summer. And Matt is with us now. Hey, Matt, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks, Nyla. Great to be here.
Can you explain a little bit more about why Reboot and PolitiFact have come together and what you all have been doing? You launched this in June, but we're going to be doing a little more focus on this on the 21st. I wanted to give you a chance to explain what you guys are doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, PolitiFact is a fact-checking website that started in 2007 to fact-check the presidential election that was going to be coming up in 2008. And it was started by the St. Petersburg Tribune, and it won the Pulitzer Prize, actually, for its coverage of the 2008 election. They have gone around and they've done partnerships in individual states with news organizations, and in the case of Missouri, they did it with the University of Missouri Journalism School, where they have they train a group of fact checkers from a publication or from an entity to practice the PolitiFact fact checking method, and that's what we have done with PolitiFact. We've started in June, got our training, and we've been fact checking. We've done a lot on the Duckworth Kirk campaign because I think that's the one that has the most national appeal. The whole country is watching that because it's such a hotly contested race, and the balance of the Senate is at stake. So we've done five so far on Kirk and Duckworth. We're also following the comptroller campaign very closely. We've done a couple on that, and we're fact checking pretty much any statement that we feel like there may be curiosity about. There is a five-point method that we use, that PolitiFact uses to decide what to fact check, and that's what we go by. But basically, it comes down to if we hear a statement and we think, is that really true, or would someone want to know if that's true? Let's take a look at that. That's kind of how it starts.
So let's go into two. We're going to take two claims today. Let's start with, as you mentioned, the Duckworth Kirk campaign has been there's been a lot of advertising. There's been a lot of statements. There's been a lot of emails. Tammy Duckworth has made a claim, Representative Duckworth, several times in campaign fundraising emails that her Republican opponent, Senator Mark Kirk, is, quote, outsourcing his campaign to a super PAC funded almost exclusively by a bunch of hedge fund billionaires, end quote. Is that true?
Well, that's our most recent fact check that we've done on this, and we rated that statement as mostly false. And there was more in the statement than the part you just read. But what the campaign mailer says basically is that Mark Kirk has outsourced his campaign fundraising, meaning handed it over to an outside group that is funded by hedge fund billionaires. Now, we take issue with the use of the term outsourced because that implies that Mark Kirk is actively participating with some outside group and went to them and outsourced, right? That's illegal. And there is a group called Independent Voice for Illinois. That is a super PAC that is founded and is devoted to, it's actually run by Mark Kirk's former chief of staff, and it's all about supporting Mark Kirk. And I don't know if we want to get into exactly what a super PAC is.
Yes, I think you should know. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
I think it's a good time to give us a reminder of what a super PAC is and what it can and cannot do.
Yeah, super PACs are something that have really, really come into the mainstream since the Citizens United Supreme Court decision in 2009. And a super PAC is a political action committee that does not have to disclose its – well, it – let me – a super PAC can spend unlimited amounts of money to support – a candidate or in opposition to anyone, But what a super PAC cannot do is coordinate in any way with any candidate. It can't give money directly to a candidate.
Or to their campaign.
Or to their campaign. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, to say that Mark Kirk is outsourcing to Independent Voice for Illinois, that's not accurate. Now, I think that what the Duckworth campaign was trying to imply, I think they were using it more colloquially, as if to say, "Oh yeah, he's."
It's his former chief of staff and a former campaign manager, so that's the tie.
But that's not what the general public hears. There's a lot of misunderstanding about how these things work. And to say that he outsourced it, you're saying that he actively solicited this outfit to do the fundraising. So we rated that not true now. Also in this statement, the Duckworth campaign implies that they are getting no help from a super PAC. That's not true either. While there is not a super PAC that is devoted strictly to Tammy Duckworth, she has gotten more than $700,000 worth of support from super PACs, from these kind of groups. Now, a candidate is powerless to stop them. A candidate can't coordinate with a group to say, "Hey, would you help me?" They also can't coordinate with a group and say, "Don't do this on my behalf," or "Stop doing this." So, our point was, you can't so strongly imply that Mark Kirk's getting all this outside help and we're getting nothing, when in fact you're getting $700,000, even though he is getting over $1 million.
Mm-hmm. All right. So that is the sort. And I like how, and that's how PolitiFact works. It says mostly false, mostly true. For people who haven't seen, there's like a little meter so you could see that. Let's move on to another claim, and that's by Comptroller Leslie Munger. And we wanted to play what she said. This was at a Chicago Sun-Times editorial debate on September 15th. She had with her Democratic opponent, Susana Mendoza.
Okay, as long as we're talking about transparency, I'd just like to mention two things. My opponent, who is talking about transparency, was on both the City of Chicago payroll and the State of Illinois payroll simultaneously, taking full salary, funding her full pension benefits, both as a city worker and as a state worker for 10 years.
I know that Susana Mendoza fired back after Comptroller Munger said that, saying this was false. How did you all rate this statement?
We rated this one half true, and in the parlance of PolitiFact, which, by the way, all of those ratings that you see, true, mostly true, half true, they are strictly defined, and half true means the statement is partially accurate, but leaves out important details or takes things out of context. The reason we ruled this one half true is that it is not true that Mendoza collected two full salaries. We found requests by Susana Mendoza from 2002, when she first got into the Illinois General Assembly, telling her city department in Chicago, "I cannot be paid on these General Assembly days." Then we went through her pension records and found that she had, in fact, made sure that she was not being paid on her city payroll during the times when she was doing General Assembly work. And it didn't directly say this, and this was a hard thing to 100% verify, but it was fairly clear that she was not funding her pension for the days that she was not getting paid by the city. She was not funding her city pension. However, she was on the General Assembly's pension plan, and she still was funding her city pension, albeit on the lower level because she had fewer salaried days. So there was some truth in that she was part of two state pension systems. She was not collecting full salary at both jobs at the same time, so there was not salary double dipping. So that's why we said that claim was half true.
All right, half true. We'll see you back, Matt, next week at this time. We're going to tweet all the links so everyone can read the work that PolitiFact Illinois is doing. By the way, can people suggest things they want PolitiFact to check on? How do they do that?
They absolutely can. And if you go to politifact.com/Illinois, you'll see you can find contact information. You can email me at matt@rebootillinois.com.
All right. Sounds great. Good. We'll tweet out all of that information, too. Thanks, Matt.
All right. Thank you, Nyla.
An incoming state lawmaker in St. Louis sent a letter to the state House speaker that has sort of rocked the state House in Missouri. And we wanted to spend a minute or two talking about that right now. The letter accuses another incoming colleague of rape. It was sent on Friday. The state House has been rocked by other sex scandals over the past 2 years. St. Louis Post-Dispatch Metro columnist Tony Messenger is the one who broke the story on Friday. And he joins us now from the newsroom to share more. Hi, Tony. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me on. Good to be here.
You interviewed the incoming representative making the accusations. She's a 31-year-old lawyer, Cora Faith Walker, who's set to represent Ferguson in the Missouri State Legislature. She asked you to identify her publicly, I should add. What did she say to you?
She described the encounter to the extent that she remembered it between her and the other lawmaker, and told me about waking up and not remembering it, and determining that that she had been sexually assaulted. Told her husband that day, and they took a while to decide whether or not to go to police, knowing that this was going to be a very public situation. And ultimately, they decided after a lot of talks with themselves and their family that it was important for them to go to police, and not only to go to police, but to decide to be very public about this, in part because the legislature has had such a history in the last few years of accusations of sexual harassment and sexual violence and poor behavior by the mostly men who dominate the legislature. And in fact, the current speaker, the Speaker of the House, Todd Richardson, who she wrote the letter to, came into office because the previous speaker resigned because of a sex scandal involving an intern.
Promised to
clean up the legislature. And so Cora Faith Walker is putting her name out there on the line saying, what are you going to do to protect women?
And I wanted to just add a note to our audience, and like most news organizations, and I imagine the St. Louis Post-Dispatch also has this policy of not identifying sexual assault victims, but she asked you to. She said that was part of why she's doing this. That's why we're also, our organization is also identifying her. But to the point, to her point about this accusation that she's made, and in the climate of what you've just described, what has been going on in the State House, and how do you think people are reacting to this most recent allegation?
Well, there's been just sort of this body fraternity atmosphere. One of the situations that happens in the legislature here in Missouri is, unlike Illinois, there are no limits on lobbyist gifts. There are no limits on campaign donations. And so there is a little bit of an anything-goes atmosphere in our capital. And it's something that's been going on for a while. And female lawmakers have complained about it, and young legislative aides and interns have complained about it. And over the last couple of years, it's become very public. The one university canceled its intern program for a period of time. Obviously, the former speaker resigned because of allegations against him. And then after he resigned, a state senator also resigned after interns spoke up and made allegations against him. And so there's just,
and we should add, this is both parties in both houses. This is
both parties, both houses, Democrats, Republicans, etc. The one commonality being women making complaints against men. And having formerly covered the Capitol as a reporter, I can tell you that in an atmosphere in which lawmakers feel entitled to free booze and free dinners and just sort of this sense of entitlement that exists in that culture, it carries over, and there is just an unhealthy atmosphere at times in that building. And women have complained about it quietly for a long time, and they've complained quietly because they feel like their jobs are on the line. And Cora Faith Walker said, I'm not going to complain quietly. I'm going to make a big deal out of this.
Tony, I'm afraid we're almost out of time, but what's been the response of from the accused by this?
He has denied wrongdoing. I spoke to his attorney Friday night, and his attorney said that the encounter was consensual. Says that he doesn't believe there's a crime here, and says he believes he has evidence that indicates that it was consensual. So that was the response from the attorney Friday night.
Well, I know we'll see. I'm sorry. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but I know there's a lot to see how this unfolds. So we'd love to check back in with you in the future and kind of see how this is unfolding.
Be glad to.
Thanks for joining us. That's Tony Messenger, Metro columnist with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, explaining what's going on in the State House in Missouri. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo.